Welcome to Rooster Radio. I'm Andrew Montesi with James Begley. And if you're looking to escape the rat race and become a master of your own destiny, this is the episode for you. Today we're talking to Finn Peacock, whose decision to quit the 9-to-5 life led to him building a home-based business that now generates $3 million in annual revenue. Finn was an engineer earning good money in a job with the CSIRO that most people would aspire to, but he hated it. The bureaucracy was so frustrating that it was impacting all aspects of his life. On the back of some passive income from ebook sales and some inspiration from Tim Ferriss's iconic book, The 4-Hour Workweek, he quit his full-time job. And that wasn't all. With two kids and another on the way, he sold the family home and began a journey from campsite to caravan park down the east coast of Australia while running his ebook business from his laptop. But it wasn't ebooks that would take Finn to the next level. With a passion for renewable energy and a booming market for solar, he started a website called Solar Quotes, a lead generation business that enables people to get three quotes from reputable local solar installers. Around 300,000 people have used the site to get quotes. Finn talks about his amazing growth and content strategies, as well as the tough stuff, which included being banished from Google search results for a year. Finn has strong opinions about how to build a business and has grave concerns about the model for building startups, which largely relies on VC money. And I should point out, Finn hasn't taken a cent of investment. There's a heap of gold here, especially for people looking to escape the rat race and start their own businesses. So let's get into it. This is Finn Peacock on Rooster Radio.
Finn Peacock, welcome to Rooster Radio.
Thank you very much.
Now, I'd love for you to describe in a bit of detail some of the frustrations and dilemmas that you had when you had a day job. What were the things that caused you to sort of reconsider your path?
Ooh, where do I start?
Jump in the deep end there.
It seems like another life, that whole 9-to-5 rat race, climb the corporate ladder thing. My biggest frustration was the lack of autonomy. Now, I have no idea if that's common to everyone. I don't think it is. I think some people like to be told what to do. It's a deep source of sadness to me when people tell me how to think, what to do, when I have to run decisions past people. So my last real job working for other people was CSIRO. And I had visions of it being, because I was working in the renewable energy division, I had visions of it being, you know, super progressive and amazing things going on. And don't get me wrong, there was some amazing technology. There was some amazing technology going on, but it was the bureaucracy, because you're essentially a public servant.
What's a practical example of that bureaucracy?
A practical example. So one example would be everything had to go through a lawyer. They were I think most people realize when they get to a certain level of corporate life is the number one priority for most managerial people is covering their ass. Like that, everything has to pass the, will I possibly ever get into trouble for this? Will it possibly ever affect my promotion? And almost anything that's worth doing will. So we had to put everything through a lawyer. That was CSIRO's kind of process. And the lawyers were very, very busy and everything got backed up. So they were very busy, very risk averse. Net result is couldn't actually do anything worth doing.
Was there a moment when you realized that this frustration wasn't normal, or like, you know, at what point did you look around and kind of go, oh, this is not for me? Like other people seem to be able to handle it, but it's just not for me.
I think there was one example where my boss, I had to write a report. I was doing commercialization of solar and wind and renewables. And I had to write a proposal, I think it was, for something. And I'm a great believer in getting the message across, especially when you're writing, in as few words as possible. So you don't waste your time, you don't waste the reader's time. It's boom. I gave my boss this like 2-page, really well-written, concise proposal. And he said, I think it needs to be about 30 pages long. Fuck. What information is not in there? He said, oh, no, it's got all the information in. But when I put it down on my boss's desk, I want it to make a thud. Boom, because that will impress him. That was game over for me. This is nuts. This is absolutely nuts.
And how old were you at this point?
That would have been 2006, so 32.
What's interesting is that job that you had, a lot of people describe it as a great job, something, a job to aspire to.
Yes. So I think I was on 120 grand a year living in Newcastle, which is pretty comfortable. Property prices, cost of living in Newcastle is pretty good. Qantas Club membership. I could fly almost anywhere I wanted in Australia at the drop of a hat. I got trips overseas, all expensed. It was a beautiful office in Newcastle, latest eco thingo office, beautiful space, some amazing stuff going on, but you've got to understand yourself and what drives you. And I was deeply unhappy because I didn't have autonomy and I had a boss that I deeply didn't get on with. And I was just deeply unhappy and I was taking it out on my family, on my, it's just ridiculous. It was absolutely insane. And it just got to a point. It was a combat. The thing that did it for me was I read the very first edition of 4-Hour Work Week in about, I was literally lying in a hammock reading it. just like the cover.
Like good
cover.
Start.
Yeah. So I had this beautiful hammock in my front garden. I got through it in an afternoon and I had the business in the background and that's what kicked me up the ass. And that's what made me quit my job, sell all my stuff, sell my house and get in the car.
So was that one of the first, I remember my experience of reading it and it felt for me that was the first piece of information that gave me the license to validate what I was feeling. Mm-hmm. And that is that this just doesn't fit me. This whole idea, this whole ambition and career thing, climb a ladder. There's more to life than that. Was that the first time that it hit you?
I've known it for a long time. That just pushed me over the edge. It got all my synapses firing. There's something about that book. It just got my imagination going. And very shortly after that, I said to Chantel, my wife, and she's awesome. I said, I've just got to quit. This is bullshit. And she was totally behind me. And then we had two kids under two and she was heavily pregnant at the time. And we had a mortgage.
Look, sorry for laboring this, but there's a lot of listeners out there that I guess, this is relevant for. I love to know, so you've told your wife, but then the next thing that you did that brought this feeling to fruition. So did you have to write a resignation letter? Did you speak to someone else about what you were going to do? What was the next action?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it was just me and Chantel talked it over. And it's, something's got to change. This is not where I want our life to be going. That we just made a decision and, it was good. It's right. Okay. Let's put the house on the market.
So at the time you had a side business, is that right?
Yeah. So I do not recommend that people, just quit their job with no, and I see that happening quite a lot. People, they hit a brick wall, they say, that's it, quit my job. And then they're like, oh shit, what am I going to do now? I had this side business. I'd grown it from nothing to $1,000 a month, which was really, really helpful when you've got quite a big mortgage, despite being on a good salary, which is another nutty thing about Western culture, or certainly Australian culture, the cost of mortgage and how much you have to earn to actually not, be scraping in every month. I had built out to $1,000 a month, and I knew that if I worked full time on it, I could probably get that up to a decent full time wage. Maybe 100 grand a year, hopefully. So there's a guy called Perry Marshall who's taught me a lot. He's a marketer in America, and he says the hardest dollar you'll ever earn online is the first dollar. He says the first dollar of profit, should I say, the first dollar of real profit is the hardest dollar you'll ever make. It's harder than your millionth, and for me, that's totally true. I tried 3 or 4 businesses before that, didn't make a jot of profit. And then I stumbled onto something that seemed to work. It was profitable. And I just knew I could, by doing the right thing, spending time on it, thinking about it more, I could get that profit up. And so and you massively reduce the risk by doing that.
And so what was it?
So that's electrical. So I'm an electrical engineer by training. Mm-hmm. That was a 66-page ebook about how to solve a very specific engineering problem called proportional integral and derivative control loop tuning. Do you want a copy?
Yeah, I've got one. Explain it to me then.
It's just going
what's the issue?
There you go, $300. $300 US for that.
Just the invoice for Easter Radio.
And people buy it every week.
$300 US.
Yep. 66 pages. It's if you're an electrical engineer in a factory or a power station, if you're a special type of electrical engineer called a control engineer, you have to control things, funnily enough. So you might have to control temperatures, pressures, humidities, any kind of physical measurement. To do that, you have used a feedback control loop. So, you know, a really simple one would be an air conditioner. Looks at the temperature. It's too hot. I need to cool it down a bit. It's too cold. I need to heat it up a bit. But if you're controlling something to a very specific tolerance, you need to heat it up just the right amount and then not overshoot and then drop it just back. And it's all about getting to the set point as quickly as possible without going unstable. And that sounds... And you use a thing called a PID control loop, proportional integral derivative. There's basically three knobs you have to twiddle. If you get those knobs exactly right, you'll get a beautifully controlled control loop. If you get it wrong, it'll go unstable or it won't get there. And that's traditionally been seen as a real black art. And there have been very highly paid engineers that specialize in this. Traditionally, you have to go on kind of a $3,000, $4,000, 3 or 4 day course to learn how to do it. I sat in one of those courses many, many years ago and thought, this is a good course. This is amazing skills, but I'm sure you could distill this into a less than 100 pages. And so I did.
And wow. You chose that because you, to run sort of as a business, because your hypothesis was, I think people will pay money for this course to get it done quicker. That was kind of your intuition, was it?
My intuition was people are paying $3,000 or $4,000 to do a course to learn how to do this. And the instructor's stretching it out over 3 or 4 days because it costs $3,000 or $4,000. Mm-hmm. So if you condense this into a book, you know, that's say a centimeter thick, that's going to be a very valuable book.
Mm. And so what did you mentioned you were making $1,000 a week?
$1,000 a month.
$1,000 a month. And you projected in your own mind that you might be able to get it up to $100,000 for a year. What did you end? What was kind of the peak?
Peak of that business was about $80,000 a year.
Okay.
And what was the catalyst to get it to that point?
I needed to put food on the table. So we sold the house. We sold a lot of our stuff. We put all the rest of our stuff in storage. And then we set off to Adelaide because my sister-in-law was coming to Adelaide for a year.
It's classic Adelaide. So I thought you were going to say because it's the tech hub of the Southern Hemisphere.
No, everyone told me Adelaide was a shithole and we believed them and we thought, well, we'll go there for a year. It can't be that bad. And then we'll disappear somewhere else. And we stayed and we loved it and we had no left.
I guess I mean a little bit more in line with the tactics that you employed online to ramp, you know, $1,000 a month into $80,000 a year plus. So tactically, what did you have to do to get your traffic up, to get acquisitions up?
We had to get traffic and we had to convert traffic and we had to, again, going back to Perry Marshall, because he's taught me a lot, this marketer in America, he has this thing called the triangle. He's got a triangle and it's conversion, traffic and economics. It's a really simple concept. So if you've got an online business, you've got to get traffic. So you get people to your website. You've got to convert them to take your offer. And then the economics is what you sell them. You optimize those three things. They're multiplicative, if that's a word. They multiply by each other. So 5% times 5% times 5%, and you've got a big change. So I got more traffic to the website through advertising and writing better content. I worked on the conversion rate through split testing, very basic stuff. And then I worked on the offer. So one of the things that really turned the needle in that business was originally I was selling the PDF as a download for $99 US. That was selling like hotcakes. And then I changed that into three offers. $99 was the cheapest budget version. There was a middle version, which was $200. And then there was a hard copy version, like the deluxe version, which was $300. And funnily enough, I doubled my income overnight because almost everyone bought the middle one.
Wow.
And can you just describe the feeling of waking up and seeing an, I don't know what sort of account you'd set up, but money's in your account. Can you describe that feeling?
We were on the south coast of New South Wales somewhere like Kiama or something like that, in our secondhand Volvo, and it needed new tyres. And it was $1,500 for new tyres. And I was thinking, you know, where am I going to get $1,500 from? That's an insane amount of money. And then I looked in the bank account for the business and it was $1,500 in there. That's when I remember, wow, this is awesome. This is like, I can actually buy tyres for my car with sales of an ebook. That's pretty cool.
So from a lifestyle perspective, then you've sold up, making your way down to Adelaide. So what was your setup? Did you have a caravan? What were you doing?
We had an old Volvo wagon. We had a roof box. We had a tent. And that was it. Oh, and a camping fridge. We had the two kids in the back, me and Chantel in the front. I bought a dongle so I could access the internet in the campsite. And I built that business after the kids had gone to bed. So from about 9 o'clock to 1 o'clock in the morning, sitting in fields down the south coast of New South Wales. And by the time we got to Adelaide, it was a full-time income.
So this question's got two parts. What were the exhilarating parts of that part of your life? And what were the parts that wore you down and maybe caused self-doubt or questions in your mind?
The exhilarating things were the freedom. You wake up, you're in a campsite, you know, maybe you're going to see the 12 apostles the next day, or maybe you're just hitting the road. It's a Tuesday. You've got no office to be in. It's just the amazing sense of freedom. And it's really nice not having a house. You know, you don't have to worry about cleaning the floors or doing the garden. There's just, because you've got almost no possessions apart from your tent. It's incredibly freeing. And even with, you know, two kids in nappies and Chantel being heavily pregnant, it was great. It was great. The stressful things were when bad weather came and there was a storm, but we just, you know, we found a cabin or we found a room when the weather got really bad. There's also the constant worry about, you know, running out of money. I mean, we had a buffer. After we sold the house, we had about 50 grand buffer in the bank, but you know, we knew that obviously wouldn't last forever. And I really didn't want to dig into it because that was our lifetime savings. So, but you were worried. We weren't having the wage coming in every month, and it takes a while to get used to that. You're 100% responsible for the money coming in every month. When I got to Adelaide, I did freak out a bit and I did look for a full-time job. You know, it kind of hit me. I've got responsibilities. I've got family. We need to get a house and, you know, rent a house and pay rent and, you know, stuff like that. So I did actually apply for a few jobs and thankfully they all knocked me back. So that was a good thing. And that's what prompted me to start Solar Quotes.
Okay. So that was my exact next question. So you got knocked back for those jobs. And then where did the Solar Quotes idea come from?
When we sold our house in Newcastle, we actually had a house that was painted pink. So I'm not a real estate expert, but I realized that if you painted it a better color, you'd probably pay back the cost of the painter and more. So, you know, I was very, very aware, didn't want to spend too much money, got a local reference of a young lad who just started his own painting company. And I did a deal with him. I said, look, how about you do me a deal on the painting and I'll set up your website for your new business. And he was like, yeah, cool. So I got the painting half price. And then I asked him how he got business. And he said, oh, there's this company. And it was called Quotify. And he said, what they do is they advertise online, get three quotes for painting. And then if those people are in my area, they send me the inquiry, I give them $30 and it works really well because I look after I give them a really good quote, I give them a really good price and I get most of my business that way. So I kind of lodged that in the back of my head as that's an interesting business model. I mean, remember that was back in 2006. Mm. And so when I was we were in Adelaide. We were actually in the Adelaide Shores campsite. That's the address we put on when Chantelle went in for her prenatal stuff, prenatal appointments at the Women and Children's. That was interesting. You tell I don't care about status. I couldn't get a job. PID was doing well. It was doing about 80 grand a year, but that's not exactly going to give you a comfortable life with three kids and let you buy a house. And the other thing was, I was sure that someone would just give that information away for free or undercut me. So I wanted two streams of income, basically. So that just popped in my head. You know, solar was starting to emerge. There was an $8,000 rebate that the government had announced. There was people starting to buy solar. I just popped, and I was passionate about renewables, and I'm an electrical engineer, and it just popped in my head, why not three quotes for solar?
And you seem like, just the way you're talking about your story so far, you have a crack at different things. You set up your own websites, you do your own research and test. Was that kind of your philosophy when you were starting out Solar Quotes?
Yeah, totally. So, I mean, I sat down for 2 weeks in the library down the road, Brighton Public Library. I sat down and I just poured everything out of my brain that I knew about solar, with being an electrical engineer and having worked at CSIRO for a while. Put up the website. It was a very basic website, ugly as sin, but some quite good information that just wasn't elsewhere on the internet. Worst case, I'd wasted 2 weeks of my time throwing all that up. And then to test it, I started buying AdWords just in Adelaide, saying, get three quotes for solar, taking them to the website and seeing if anyone actually filled out the form to get three quotes. And people started filling it in, like, almost immediately.
Wow.
I didn't have any clients at that time. So what I did was I just went to contact forms on big solar companies' websites. So I did fulfill my part of the bargain. I tried to get them three quotes by just filling in the forms for them. And yeah, I tried that for a couple of days, and I looked at my conversion rates, looked that I could make a profit if I sold leads at $30 each back then. And yeah, so right, I think I've got a business here. And then I started, I did a snail mail campaign. I scraped a list of solar installers off various websites, bought a cheap laser printer, printed out a very personal letter, hand signed them all to every solar installation company in Adelaide saying, look, I've got this website. It's got loads of information on it. We've got people coming to the website wanting quotes. Here's the offer to you. I will send you 40 leads for people who really do want to buy solar. All I ask is that you follow up those leads, you try to sell to them. And if after you've got 40 leads, you think those leads are worth $30 each, then you pay me $1,200. And hopefully you've made $10,000, $20,000 worth of sales out of that. If you don't think they're worth $1,200, just let me know and you'll never hear from me again. Wow. And so I totally took the risk out of it for them. That was the only risk for them, was wasting a bit of time on these leads. Sent that to every solar company in Adelaide. I only got one person got back to me and said, yeah, I'll give it a go. And that was the start of my business. So that was Adelaide Solar Systems, who's still a client. You know, they took a punt on me. They really like the leads. They've been a client ever since, really.
Just one step back. It seems so powerful that you've got the time and the freedom to do this. I mean, with one of our early Rooster Radio guests, Ben Fitzsimmons, always talks about buying your time is the most valuable thing you'll ever do. And it seems to me this was, you know, this journey through to Adelaide was a pivotal part of setting up the next phase of your life.
Yeah, it gives you the clarity of mind to just sit and think, you know, you're driving those long distances, you're in a field with no distractions. Just amazing. You know, clarity of mind is just boom. This is what I need to do. I'm going to do it. I've got no distractions. I've got no house to clean. I've got no possessions to worry about. I've got no office politics. Yeah.
I speak to a lot of my mates and they seem to have these amazing ideas, but the hamster wheel effect is they just never get the time to actually progress the idea. And so clearly that's what you've had.
They should progress it to the point where they've taken 80% of the risk out of it, which is getting someone to do something or take the action you want them to do.
Yep.
Make your first dollar's profit. And that's the way to know it's successful. It's actually a dollar of real profit. And then you've got to just, you've just got to go for it. I mean, Tim Ferriss says, what's the worst that can happen? Mm. What is the worst that can happen in Australia? Because if you quit your job, you get another fucking job, right? Mm. It's not the end of the world, right? It's just not. And I took that away from the book. I said, what is the worst that can happen? The worst that can happen is we get to Adelaide, we run out of money, and I've got to get another job.
Yeah. You've mentioned some of the things that worked. What were there any strategies up until this point that really just went nowhere?
Ooh, at what stage?
Early on.
So you got to a point now, you've got your first client, proper client for Solar Quotes, but leading up to that point, you've talked about snail mail, you've talked about scraping website. I mean, were there any things that you did which you got nothing back on?
Probably my biggest error building Solar Quotes has been SEO. It's been engaging third parties to do SEO on your site and thinking that SEO is about tricks and techniques and knowing the secret sauce, which it's not. I mean, there's certain knowledge you need to have, but at the end of the day, I engaged a guy in Canada who came highly recommended. It was very expensive. And I said to him, hey, no black hat SEO. You know, I know what happens with black hat SEO. You get banned that's, you know, kiss of death for your business. Google cracks the shits with you.
Just to explain what it is for those.
Well, black hat SEO is spammy SEO. So building spammy links, building spammy sites, buying links, all that.
All just the dodgy stuff.
Getting links through dodgy means. He's like, yeah, no, all white hat. And being an idiot, I didn't actually... I just bought the dream. I just thought, yeah, I can give him money and I'll get traffic. Awesome. So he starts black hatting the shit out of my site for about 4 months. And then Google does a manual penalty. So that's someone actually looks at the site and decides, hits the big button and says, you're not getting any organic traffic because you've been a naughty boy.
And does it literally drop off?
I was zero organic traffic for about a year.
Wow.
At the cusp of my business when we were, you know, really motoring. The other lesson there is don't ever rely on one source of traffic, right? We rely on about 12 sources of traffic. Mm. So one of those, a big source of traffic dropped to zero, but we survived. And we actually did pretty well because we're very good at paid traffic and very good at other sources of traffic. It took me a year and tens of thousands of dollars to climb out of that hole.
So what did that look like? Did you get an email from Google or did you one day wake up, look at your analytics and go, hang on a sec, what's happening here?
You get an email from Google saying we've taken a manual penalty against your site.
And so were you aware at the time that maybe your SEO guy, maybe he's doing things.
Yeah, I had a gut feel, yeah. Yep. And I didn't trust my gut on that one. And they make you, when you use spammy SEO, Google punish you, man. I mean, this thing called disavowing all these links. And more than that, you've got to prove to Google that you've rang up virtually every bloody site and begged them to remove the link. And you've got to document that. So it was an enormous amount of work to crawl out of that hole. And we did.
A year's worth of work.
Yeah.
Did you ever want to just set up another site?
No, I didn't because the site was getting traction and it had a brand, you know, people knew about it and the business worked just with the other forms of traffic and I knew I could claw out of it. I knew fundamentally, you know, we're a good ethical business that was trying to do the right thing, but just being a bit naive.
And this may take you back one step slightly, but in terms of building the ecosystem of your marketplace, you got your clients, the companies, and then you've got the traffic.
Yeah.
What did you ever have any issues with getting that balance right of, too many people clicking through and not having enough suppliers and companies or vice versa, companies not getting enough leads, so they're unhappy. How did you, I guess, foster that ecosystem?
That is a good question. Yeah. So, I mean, you always run the risk that you'll get leads that you can't sell. And you always run the risk that you won't have enough leads for your clients. We're very lucky that most of the time we've turned people away for being full. And that's because lead generation, if I researched too hard, I'd have never got into the business because I've been scared off. Lead generation is generally speaking, a nasty business full of crooks who just in really short-termist, they'll get shit traffic, shit leads, and sell them for as much as they can. And I've always, because my motivation is not, my main motivation is autonomy, I want my business to last as long as possible. The worst thing I can think of, barring the obvious stuff like death and disease, is losing my autonomy and having to get a job, you know, having a boss again. I mean, it just fills my heart with dread. So I want a business that's going to last and it's going to be sustainable. And to do that, you need to, you know, it's not rocket science. You'll live or die by the quality of what you sell. So I've always forsaken volume for quality in terms of leads. And on a very simple level, that means having quite a complicated lead funnel, if you like, which is the process they go through to get the leads. So you get a lot of people dropping out, but you increase the quality of your leads. So your short-term revenue goes down because you're selling less leads, but the happiness of your clients goes up. And more important than that, your churn of your clients is reduced. And that makes for a really low-stress business.
So in terms of quality, it's an interesting point because in my perceptions of the solar market is that there would certainly be some cowboys lured in by a quick buck rebates at the time. How did you go about maintaining quality, vetting these companies and that process?
So that, yeah, there's two sides to the quality. There's the quality of the leads and then there's the quality of the companies you refer. And like you say, there's a constant, you've got to be constantly mindful that you've got enough companies to send the leads to. So we do our best to get people three quotes. So in a perfect world, every single person that requests three quotes would get three. In reality, it's 2 point something because it's never perfect, what I call utilization rate. Now, if I took on some of the big companies that I consider to be shonks, I could have a perfect three utilization rate and I could have had it for years because there's some massive companies that serve the whole of Australia and have asked me for leads multiple times, but I turn them down. And it's a very, so we have a 24 point vetting procedure for companies. But even before we get to that, as someone that's been in the solar industry now for 10 years, I just say to myself, would I recommend, if my grandma came to me right now and said, Finn, I'm going to get solar, would I hand on my hat, say, yep, get a quote off this company? And if it's no, don't recommend it to people that trust your website.
The grandma test.
It's not rocket science.
I've heard of the pub test. Now the grandma test.
It's got to be your grandma because your grandma's quite vulnerable, right? And open to being
a Somalian dear sir letter. you mentioned about that sort of burning ambition not to get a job. Proper job. Can you describe how your routine now has evolved? What components are in your day that are important to your performance and your life?
The most important one is, well, I wake up, have breakfast with the kids, I take the kids to school. That's super important. So to have connected with the kids in the morning, super important, and to not be rushed.
Why has that been important for you?
Just really fucking hate being rushed. I rarely, because I need, again, I'm biased because I'm just talking about myself, but I need space to think. And I just see so many people running around who haven't got the space to think and they're making bad decisions and they're fighting fires. And if they just rose up above it all and made a couple of core good decisions, they'd free up all this time for themselves. And their soul would just be in such a better place. So, yeah, it's just really important to have space and have time to think. And it actually, you, in my experience, you get a lot more success by making good decisions than running around being busy. And, you know, a lot of people I see get a lot of status from how are you today? Oh, busy, mate, busy. Mm. People ask me, how am I doing? Oh, yeah, I'm good. What did you do at the weekend? I hung out with my kids, rode my bike. I don't know. You know? For some people, that might sound like you're wasting your life, but, you know, I really enjoy being alive and I really enjoy having space to think and hanging out with my kids and riding my bike. So
that was that's the morning. Are there any other pieces?
Immediately after that. So I take them to school and then I immediately go off on an hour's mountain bike ride, which I've done this morning. There's an amazing, Adelaide's got over 200 kilometers of a purpose-built mountain bike single track. Not a lot of people know that. It's total fluke, but it's... I've been mountain biking all over Australia and I think it's the best urban mountain biking in the country. It's absolutely phenomenal. So I go for a mountain bike ride, get my nature fix and my endorphin fix. And I come home and I don't check my email. Sometimes you do check your email because you just know there's something in there, but try not to check my email and get 2 or 3 hours work, you know, kind of high level, high value work done. Creative stuff or solving a problem in the business or I've just yesterday handed in my manuscript to my book editor, so I've just been obsessed with getting that done the last few weeks, but really high value creative stuff, you know, creating assets, creating, solving problems, you know, whatever, and then I fire up my email usually after lunch
because we're sitting in your I guess your workstation. Is this your workstation?
Or yeah, is this the office.
No, this is the office.
Yep.
And just behind you, you've got a quote which says, "What core principle, if heeded, would solve this problem?" And I was going to ask you why that was an important phrase for you.
It's just thinking about stuff at a high level. Most solutions are much simpler than you realize. And, you know, almost everything's already been solved. And it's all, you know, usually comes down to core principles. So instead of just getting lost in the detail, it's just a reminder to rise up above it all. Again, that's a quote from Perry Marshall.
In terms of the business, for some context, how big is it now? Did it get to a certain point and then reduce? I mean, can you give us a little bit of context in terms of some of the core numbers of the business? Obviously, only giving away what you want to give away there.
Yeah. No, it turns over about $3 million a year. There's 7 of us working full time and a couple of contractors who work on and off. It grew very, very quickly in the first year because we were following the market, the solar market. Mm. We call it the solar coaster, the people in the solar industry. You know, it's driven by government rebates and government policy, unfortunately, which can make it a challenge. So you've got to be lean because you can have a cracking year 1 year and then you can have a really quiet year the next. And it's plateaued at that for about the last 4 years, although this year is looking like being a really good one because we've done some stuff that's made a big difference to traffic more than anything. I mean, 7 employees, $3 million a year. Everyone works from home, apart from Jono, who's 26, I think, and hasn't been poisoned by office culture because this is his first job out of uni. So he gets, he's got a permanent desk in the hub in town, which is a pretty cool space.
I'm also thinking, what a classic Australian name for someone to work in your business. Jono.
Jono, mate.
Jono. He probably plays footy as well.
So other stats, we just kicked over 300,000 people registered with the website. Yeah. There's 9 million homes in Australia, so that's 1 in 30 homes in Australia, so that's pretty cool.
Mm.
We've got a couple of hundred solar installer clients across Australia.
When you are keeping tabs, a bit of a dashboard, what are the metrics that you're really keeping an eye on, which are indicators of, I guess, the health of the business?
All our software is custom written. 2 of those guys are coders. You've got John that runs IT, and then we've got Claudio that codes for him, and they both code. So we've built our entire backend's built from scratch because I wanted full control over everything we do. As an engineer, there's nothing more frustrating for me. Again, it comes down to autonomy as well. I didn't want to be reliant on some software company to be able to add a feature. You know, it's knowing what's important to you. And I think it's worked out well for the business. You know, we need this feature. The software company says, we can't do that. Sorry, I'll just do my head in. So we built the whole thing from scratch. And so we've got a custom dashboard, which shows me volumes of leads coming in, where they've come from, revenue per lead, customer feedback in terms of reviews from the people that actually get the leads. We track that very closely. And then we compare this week with the same week last year and see how we're going year on year. That's the high level metrics. And then when you can see at a glance if there's a problem, and you pick up the problems fairly quickly.
In terms of reviews, I read that you've had a couple of issues in the past with companies being reviewed and potential lawsuits because you haven't taken down reviews. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about that and perhaps how you've dealt with those kind of issues? Because some people would certainly panic at the threat of a lawsuit.
Oh, it's scary as shit, especially the first time it happens. Yeah, you learn very quickly how things operate, right? So someone has a solar company, say, and there's a scathing review published on our website by someone who's used that company. Generally what that company will do is, well, they do either one. If they're complete shonks, they'll send you a personal email saying, I am going to sue you for slander or defamation or whatever. If you don't take this website down, take it down immediately. Or if they're a bit more sophisticated, they'll get a lawyer to do it. Generally, they can struggle to get a lawyer to do it because the lawyer will know that it's a frivolous kind of threat, and they can get into trouble for that. But you know, sometimes you'll get the lawyer, and the first time you get a lawyer's letter, it's scary as shit. You know, you think, visions of losing your house and all this stuff. And we can talk about how to protect your capital, because that's something that's important when you publish a lot of stuff online, especially when a lot of it isn't stuff you've written. So we've got a very simple policy for reviews. If it's true, it stays up. If it's true and it's not personally defamatory, it stays up. I understand the law in Australia quite well now, and that's fine. If it's true, that's a defense against anything. Mm-hmm. And also, Australia's got this brilliant law that makes it very hard for companies to sue for defamation if they're over a certain mm-hmm. size. But it shouldn't be defamatory anyway, because defamatory means that it's not true or it's unfair.
Mm.
So,
and what steps do you take to try and ascertain how true it is?
So if a company comes to us and says, look, I mean, the nice guys will say, hey, look, someone's put this review on your site. It's totally not true. I never heard of this person. You know, we'll investigate it. You know, we'll say, well, first of all, can you just prove you're a customer? Can we see the invoice? And then we'll talk to the people involved and we'll ascertain, you know, what the truth is. And if it's true, it stays up. We always give, any company can put a right of reply underneath. And, you know, it's worked well. I mean, over the last 8-9 years. But you know, there's a lot of companies out there that can't stand the thought of something going online that they don't officially sanction, and they will get really nasty and make all sorts of threats. You know, I've got a good lawyer, and I get him to write a letter back explaining what the law is and why it's staying up. But you know, having said that, it's an interesting one, because I talk to people. Solar industry attracts, and this is a good thing, it attracts people that want to start businesses, that want to do the right thing, make a good change in the world, solve the climate crisis. But hardly any of them get started because they either spend way too much time doing research or way too much time talking to lawyers. Like I was talking to one guy the other day. He's got nowhere, but he said, you know, I've just been with my team of lawyers for 2 days talking about wargaming, what could possibly go wrong with sticking solar on people's roofs. I'm like, well, just what? And I say that because about a year into my business, talking to a lawyer about the business, and he basically said, take all those reviews off your site. It's just too risky, legal-wise, bloody, bloody, bloody. You know, if you've got content on your site, it's not being written by you. And, you know, you just, common sense kicks in. You go, hang on, I'm not the only person doing this.
That's why lawyers never start businesses, though, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, so if you talk to a lawyer for too long, you'll never start a business, because every business has got risk. Yeah. But you do sensible stuff, like you have capital protection. You know, you talk, so if you do get, you know, tied down in a frivolous lawsuit, or, you know, or you just have some bad luck and you get sued for a lot of money, you don't lose everything. Mm. And that's a fairly simple thing to do if you talk to your lawyer.
Through this journey, what have been some, you've mentioned Tim Ferriss, you've mentioned Perry Marshall. Who else has been important for you? I mean, clearly you read a lot and you absorb information.
Yeah. Who else has been important? So Alan de Botton, because he got me into philosophy. Who else? There's a brilliant book called Utility, spelled Y-O-U-tility, called by a guy called Jay Bauer. If you're creating content online, I think it's one of the best books you can ever read. That didn't actually inspire me to do stuff the way I do it, but I read it after the fact and thought, wow, this guy has just described everything I've done and how I've done it and why I've done it. That's amazing.
Can I pause you there because I'm a content man and
I might just sit back for the next 10 minutes.
I love what you do with content. So I want to kind of pick apart kind of your philosophies there with content. Mm-hmm. Why initially you started blogging. I mean, you're a prolific blogger creating a heap of content. You admit, you said that you read about it and then realized that's what you'd been doing. When you first started creating this content, what were you thinking? What were the outcomes? What did you expect to happen?
I thought someone who's buying solar, let me put myself in their position. What do they want to know? And how can I present it to them in a way that's totally independent? So I'm not trying to get a sale. Like if you're selling solar, your content, no matter how hard you try, is always going to be contaminated with you wanting them to buy what you sell. And so, yeah, just putting it out there, you know, what, and that, you know, so many people are afraid to put prices online. So many people are afraid to put brands online and name brands and say, you know, I would not buy this brand. It's a piece of junk. Because people think you can get sued or for saying that. You can't. If it's a personal opinion and if it's a company bigger than 10 employees in Australia, you're safe anyway because of the, we've got very good laws like that. So yeah, you know, again, you know, if you're giving your friend advice with and you know all about this industry, but all these insider kind of knowledge, you know, why would the average man on the street know what solar panel brands are good? They wouldn't. So we tell them which ones you'd buy, which ones you'd avoid. And then also as an engineer, I know there's people out there that want to go a level deeper and go into actually how it works and why it works. And so you go that to that level as well. And you just answer questions that people have and you just.
So you're creating content that isn't salesy.
Yeah.
So can you tell us how you still manage to create a business case for it? Because a lot of people will say that and go, well, that's great, it's creating all this content, but how am I going to get paid from it?
Well, again, it's about long-term, right? So we were solar quotes for probably the first 3 years was almost entirely paid traffic. And then just as we started to get traction, we got the Google whack. It's just a belief that if you put good information up there, and you don't crowd it out with ads. And, you know, we've got one call to action on every page, which is, you know, if you want to get 3 quotes for solar, put your postcode in here and hit the button. So you're not fighting your way through adverts. We never allow people to pay us to write stuff. I got accused of cash for comment the other week. I was like, what? I've never taken money for writing stuff on solar quotes. Just the belief that if you write good, useful stuff and share it around, eventually people will start linking to it and you'll start to build up some organic traffic. And then people will refer it to your friends. And the other thing was, so in the medium to long term, you are highly likely to get there. And because we bought so much traffic in the early days, that kind of put a rocket under it because you were getting all these eyeballs on it, which increased the chance of people sharing it and finding out about it. And also the way AdWords works is, you know, they have a quality score. And part of that is if you've just got a landing page that just tries to squeeze every last user into converting, into getting quotes, you're going to have a high bounce rate, right? Whereas if you've got a page that gives them loads of information and draws them in, you know, the Google algorithm sees that they're engaged in your site and they reward you with cheaper advertising. So although it didn't get us organic traffic for many years, like, you know, any kind of decent organic traffic for many years, it was a real competitive advantage in terms of AdWords. We were getting conversions cheaper than anyone else. Because Google could see, it gave us a high quality score because it could see that people were spending a lot of time on the site. I mean, the other thing is that I learned after we got Google whacked is, and it's so fucking obvious, which is why people don't do it, I think. Ask Google what you have to do to get good organic traffic because they probably know, right?
Hmm.
And Google say, if you want to get good organic traffic, right, high quality, well-researched content that solves people's problems. That's all else to tell you. And most people go, yeah, oh, fucking thanks a lot. That's great. Yeah, but what about the tricks and this and this? And after I got Google worked, I just sat down and thought about that. And I just started making sure. And I'd kind of been writing that anyway, but I just really ramped up I just always had that in the back of my mind. I ramped it up, and then a couple of years ago, I actually hired someone to do that full time. And since we've seen a massive step change in our organic traffic since I took on that guy, because his proof is try well researched, high quality content that solves people's problems.
Not trying to follow, Google Panda has just come out and this little algorithm is tweaked and now I've got to change my whole website. How many blogs would you have on your site?
How many blog posts?
Yeah, how many pages, how many pieces of content would you have built up to now?
I mean, we've got user reviews on our site, so that's kind of distorts it. So I think there's about 25,000 of those. So that's 25,000, although they're not separate pages these days, because you do have to think about on-site optimization as well. And one of the things we've done is not have a separate page for each review. But I don't know, there's hundreds and hundreds of blog posts, hundreds of pages of other content, tens of thousands of reviews, gazillions of blog comments. And we try to answer every question that we get in the blog comments quite comprehensively and be useful.
It's a huge piece of IP, isn't it? Like there's so much invested into it. It's a long game.
Don't try and build it. You hear it all the time, people say, oh, I'm going to build this solar quotes for, lawn, people that sell lawns, get three quotes to get your lawn. Someone I was talking to the other day, and his whole business model, well, I'm going to get the traffic for free and then I'm going to sell our leads for $50 each. So I'm going to make $150 gross margin every time someone fills out my form. And I'm like, well, how are you going to get traffic for free? Well, Google's going to give it to me. I say, that might happen eventually, but don't. It's years away. It's, because it's a low barrier to entry, obviously, and a lot of people, you're not going to be the only person in the world that wants traffic for people buying lawns.
Is there a piece of content which either caused some controversy or that you're particularly proud of, or a couple of pieces of content that stick in your mind over the journey?
One that went ballistic around the world was, the Tesla Powerwall. Elon Musk stood up and announced it May 2015, I think. And as seems to be a pattern with Tesla, between him announcing the Powerwall at a certain price and it actually being released and getting installed, if you worked out the cost per unit of electricity stored, it was double of what he promised, based on going into the warranty and seeing what they actually warranted and how much it degraded. And I sat down and I wrote that piece one night. I think the headline was something like how the cost of Powerwall storage doubled in 12 months, between him announcing it and releasing it. I think I was the first person in the world to actually dig into the warranty and actually work out what you were going to get for your money and look at the cost of it getting installed in Australia, because Australia leads the world on this stuff, because we've got such a buoyant solar market and such low feed-in tariffs that batteries make more sense here than other places. And that just went around the world and, got us a lot of links and, got us quite well known in the solar industry, not just in Australia. We were very well known in the solar industry in Australia then, but also internationally. So that was a good one.
It's a good point in that in terms of where I'm interested in where you think, the energy market is at, broadly speaking, in a world with Elon and that kind of fandom and people not looking into the detail because they get caught up in the announcements and the PR and the big stories. Where are we at, in terms of the energy market?
Where are we at? We're at a place now, in Australia, where if you own a roof, it's kind of insane not to fill it with solar panels. If you look at the internal rate of return you can get on solar, it's amazing that I think we're at about 25% penetration. It's amazing. That 75% haven't put it on the roof yet. Yeah, a lot. Big chunk of those will be renters, and there's no one's come up with a good solution for renters yet. Which, having been a renter almost all my life up until a few years ago, upsets me. It's interesting because people are getting carried away with batteries. They're getting wired by Elon Musk. Now they're all talking about these solar roof tiles. We've got all the technology and all the tools we need to run this country off 100% renewables. Let's stop waiting for these fancy roof tiles, these fancy batteries. If you want a battery, you can get them now. So many people are delaying buying solar because they're just skimming the media. Mm. And the media, the mainstream journalism is absolutely shocking when it comes to solar and batteries. They're either innumerate or too lazy to do the maths or look into it deeply. And you can't blame them because, you know, journalism is getting decimated. Well, you can't blame them, actually. They're journalists. They should fucking do their research. But as you say, you've got people it's the thing that's really frustrating is you've got people putting solar on their roof. These people with incredibly high electricity bills, they're not getting solar because they think they have to wait for batteries. And it's absolutely nuts. You can get a like 40% internal rate of return by whacking solar on your roof right now if in certain situations.
As you seem to take a meaningful and genuine approach to your business, you know, you play the long game, you know, you're not trying to cut corners. You want to build a solution, a true solution. How disheartening is it though when political leaders come in and whether it's rhetoric or it's playing politics, you know, in America now it's Trump's talking about coal. We've had the CSIRO stripped of money. We've had money taken out of the, you know, renewable energy fund. Symbolically, that is it disheartening to just feel this little moment kind of go back a step?
Yes, but you learn to not worry too much about what you can't control because it just gets depressing. So we're past the tipping point in terms of the cost of renewables, where they are the future. I mean, if this had happened 5 or 6 years ago, it'd be you know, the Trump thing, that would be a problem. But we're past the tipping point now, so no one's going to build any coal-fired power stations in Australia. It's just economics. So I'm not too worried. I'm very worried about climate change, but I'm not too worried about, you know, the whole Trumpism and the short-term political idiots messing things up. Renewables are on that exponential growth.
It feels to me that this is the craziest part about it, is that the commercial opportunity is so great now in the renewable space. You get companies and corporates actually going, well, regardless of what the policy is, we're going to find a way to make money out of this because it makes good business sense. It feels to me that that's kind of a bit of a, feeling.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, totally. The economics is all in renewables' favour now. I mean, it wasn't 6 or 7 years ago, but it's there. And that's, it's unstoppable. Yeah.
Well, it's good because Andrew's actually a climate change skeptic. So,
You're just trying to stitch me up here.
Just get out.
I had to wake you up.
I'm talking about renewables. I'm sitting here in this beautiful, sustainable home. Come on, mate. Jeez. But I will take you down another path, which I think is quite emotive for you, and that is, I guess, the philosophy around building a business and a startup. I saw you speak a couple of years ago, and it was very interesting, particularly in terms of the way the world is now, the expectations about building a startup, go and get VC funding, and this certain model that has emerged. How do you feel about that, having, as James said, built a business that is kind of about authenticity and it's a true business?
I deeply dislike the word startup. I think it's hijacked the concept of just starting a business, and, you know, that business may grow fast. It may not grow fast, but the idea that a business is only legitimate if it's a fast growth startup is absolutely, I just think it's toxic. And I think it's created a lot of misery for people that are chasing that dream. The standard model is, you know, you have an idea, you get some seed funding, then you get more funding, and then you try and throw all this money at it at the hope of it growing really quickly, and then you flip it at the peak. How's that adding value to the world? You know, it worked for, it's, you're just stacking the odds. It's a long, long, long shot. You know, that's the kind of thing you do when you're comfortable and you're in a position where you can do that. And it's not going to kind of ruin your life or set you back or bankrupt you. I just think it's toxic. I think it's driven by greed, and it's driven by people.
Who's greed?
Society's greed, and I think the entrepreneur's greed. And I think, you know, chasing, it's the new celebrity, isn't it? You know, it's the, you know, if you want to, you know, I was a child actor, but that's another story. If you want to act, you should act because you love acting. You shouldn't act because you want to be famous. And I imagine, I, I've never done the stats, but I imagine that most of the really famous, long-lasting, happy, high-quality actors went into acting because they liked acting, not because they wanted to be famous, right? And the same with business. You shouldn't go into business because you want to be a rock star, you know, a rock star entrepreneur. You should go into business because you want to, well, for whatever the reasons are, you know, personal to you. For me, they were autonomy. And they were, you know, I've got this purpose in renewable energy that I wanted to follow and I've got an interest in it. But that's why you should go into business. And that doesn't mean that you're going to get investment and grow fast necessarily and, you know, follow this pattern that you've seen in, you know, in Silicon Valley and in the movies. And it's just really unlikely to work.
Do you talk with many people that have started businesses that hold themselves against that benchmark and feel continually like they're failing if they're not hitting those sort of huge levels of growth?
Yeah, or I'm just trying to, is this true? I think all the really happy, successful business people I know have organically grown their business and have taken on no outside investment and have grown it over the, they've bootstrapped the shit out of it initially. And it's taken them many, many, many years to build, a very, very robust business.
I'm glad you mentioned this, Finn, because we've had some people, some VCs knock on Rooster Radio door and really want to scale our podcast business because we love podcasts.
Oh, I think it was Andreessen Horowitz that called me.
He wanted to put us in a Y Combinator and
not quite. It's a very much organic growth here at Rooster Radio.
But I take your point and I completely agree with you that there's the now formula for startup is kind of anti what startup initially was, which was just get something going. There aren't any formulas. You just got to find a way, hack your way.
With no resources
and solve problems. And now it seems that there's a very rigid formula to, you know, for what is a successful startup.
That's right. You're the software as a service model. So you do this. Absolute bullshit. I mean, and it's not a very good formula because it does 90% of the time it doesn't work. Mm.
So just on that. So just on that, are there any specific? You've mentioned funding. You've talked about taking a while to grow organic traffic and grow. You know, it costs you money to gain traffic initially. What else do you see as a myth in the early stages of growing business?
That you've got to go grow fast or you'll go broke because someone will steal your spot. And you need lots of money to do that. So we put our biggest competitor for a long time, ironically, was Quotify, which is the idea I copied for the three quotes. So they were bought out. They were never in the solar power business, but then they got bought out by Telstra. And then they jumped into, get quotes for solar and they had deep pockets, man. They were the biggest spender on AdWords for a long time. And that's a big chunk of our traffic. Certainly was back then. And then I was sitting in the car driving the kids somewhere about 3 years ago. And I almost never have the radio on, but I had the radio on and the news said, and in other news, online service that gets three quotes for, and I'm thinking, oh, fuck, what have we done? We're in the news. Quotify has just announced that it's shutting down. And I was like, yes, come on. So with all Telstra's money behind it, they couldn't make that work.
But it's a frustration, but I guess it's a strength if you play the long game, isn't it? Because you're up against people that want the quick return. They have high growth metrics. And as soon as it doesn't quite stack up, they then potentially are out.
It's just having a long-term mindset. It's as simple as that. You just shift your thinking from short-term to long-term and that changes a lot of your decisions. And I think it makes for a more robust business, touch wood.
And this approach though, I'm thinking, what are your views on the broader implications? Now, government trying to get involved in this whole startup approach and trying to get a piece of the pie, it's become mainstream. What, I mean, in terms of the economic impact, how do you see it?
It's just jumping on a bandwagon. And it's, I just don't think it's an efficient way to spend money. You know, the people that do well out of it is the VCs, because every now and again they get the unicorn, and then they've got so much money they can afford to lose money for the, you know, for 95% of their investments. But it's just widening the inequality between the rich and the poor, and it's you just see emotional the damage it does to lives is horrendous.
And how do these views sit though? Because I mean, I see you speak at an event where, you know, it's an event for an organizations that are kind of probably promoting this world. And then you go out and say these things, you know, there are a few awkward moments. I mean, you're not the sort of guy, I think, who's going to back down or alter your views for an audience.
Well, there's a lot of stuff I don't get invited to. Yep. And that's fine. There's stuff I don't get invited back to. And then there's, you know, there's the really cool guys that respect your opinion and, you know, like Flinders are good like that. And they have you back and you kind of get a name for yourself as the guy that says this wacky stuff that some people listen to and some people don't. I don't know.
My last question before we, look, we always finish with rapid fire, a short series of hopefully short answer questions. I guess for me, do you have any other online businesses in the pipeline that you'd love to execute at some point?
I have about 27 ideas a day for online businesses, and then I forget them all. Solar Quotes is awesome. I love it. That's what I'm doing. I've got to be really careful to restrain myself because I have so many ideas every day. I mean, it blows me away that people don't start a business because they don't have an idea. You know, just send me an email and I'll give you one of mine. But people think, again, you know, that's a myth, isn't it? People think it's all about the idea. It's not. It's about the execution. So there's nothing. I mean, there's a million I want to start, but I'm not going to start any of them because I'm really happy where I'm at, and I know where Solar Quotes is going, and we've got a plan, and it's a business that's needed, and if people find it really useful, because we know that from the feedback, you know, we've got like 2,500 reviews, average 5 stars, which is pretty damn good for a lead generator, and our clients need us, and the solar industry is too important to. You know, get bored and jump into something else. So, yeah, there's nothing on the radar.
What is the goal for Solar Quotes? I mean, I don't think it's an acquisition from Telstra.
You never know.
Fuck that. God, they have anything worse.
I think you'd work really well in a government organisation.
You've got to serve out.
Adelaide's a government town. Maybe you could find a nice managerial position.
Look, 80% of Australians haven't got solar on their roof yet. If our mission is to make it easy, low risk, and fun to get good quality solar on your roof. So there's two sides to that. There's one, get people buying solar. Because if you educate people about solar cells itself, if people start doing the research, and it really does now. But the other thing is you want them to buy good quality solar because there's some absolute shit out there that will be in landfill in 3 or 4 years and that hasn't helped anyone, right? It does more harm than good. So we want to get people buying good quality solar. We want to make it easy for them. We want to make it low risk. I hate the thought of people getting ripped off. You know, you've got the guys that sell the absolute crap for nothing, and then you've got the guys that sell whatever they sell for 5-6 times the price they should. And I want people to avoid those guys and go with the happy middle ground. You know, the good companies that are saying good gear and will support it. And then I want to help good solar installers thrive. You know, I want to help those guys thrive. And because they're not marketers, they don't want to be, you know, dedicating their lives to working out the Google AdWords algorithm or whatever. And then we've got a long way to go because only 20% of people or whatever the number is now, it's growing quickly, have got solar. And then, you know, batteries are coming along. You know, give it 10 years. I agree with Tesla that everyone will have a battery. I've got a battery. Down the side of the house there, just got it installed. Batteries don't make economic sense now, and we can say that because we've got this long-term thinking. There's a lot of solar companies that, you know, and I understand it. They probably need to sell batteries to help their revenue, and so they're a bit biased towards the benefits. But if you sit down and coldly look at the economics of batteries and the environmental effects of batteries right now, I wouldn't recommend my grandmother buy one, so I don't recommend people buy them, certainly for economic reasons. If they want to get one to play with, that's great. Go for it. But that battery, when, you know, having a battery will be as common as getting a car. every roof that's not shaded will have solar soon, because it's, you know, the price is coming down all the time, and the electricity prices, I think, are only going up. So it's an incredibly exciting industry, and it's going to be at least as big as the car industry. And, you know, so there's a lot to do.
Okay, rapid fire. Did you have any shit names for your business before you ended with the one that you've got?
Did I have any shit names? No, Solar Quotes is the one that popped straight into my head. And then I went to GoDaddy and it was available as a .com.au. So I stuck with it.
As a child actor, if I was to look you up on IMDb, what would be your, biographies or?
Yeah.
Where did you appear?
I did a bit of theatre and I did one TV program.
What was it?
It was a English kids TV program. It was part of a series called The Book Tower, where they dramatised the book. And I was a school bully in a book called Hairs in the Palm of Your Hand.
Had nothing to do with Sooty. Do you remember?
Sooty was great.
Sooty.
Sooty and Sweep.
What car do you currently drive?
Volvo XC70, about 5 years old.
Starting a business, online business, what are the three books that I should read?
Three books that you should read.
And we're looking 80, at
80-20 Sales and Marketing by Perry Marshall.
Yep.
The 4-Hour Workweek. I've written a page of that. So make sure you read page 365.
Oh, really?
Status Anxiety by Alan de Botton.
You didn't mention PID Tuning Blueprint.
If you want to start a PID tuning business, you should probably read that book.
Favorite, or can be in the top few favorite movies?
About Schmidt.
Really?
Yeah.
I found it such a grind. It was painful.
I loved that movie.
Painful. Like, it really evoked like this frustrating, but very slow moving kind of movie.
You bagged me for slowing down our rapid fire, and you've gone on this.
Well,
rant.
Only because strikes me as that's an amazing movie to have in your top few.
I absolutely love that movie.
If you're an Australian, you go Shawshank Redemption, or you'd say Anchorman.
Yeah. No. 25th Hour. Have you seen that? The original Ghostbusters.
What went through your mind during Adelaide's blackout period?
The lyrics to a Michael Franti song, because I was at a Michael Franti concert in Melbourne.
What were the lyrics?
Whatever I was singing at the time at the top of my voice. We left the kids with grandma and they had a blackout while we were in Melbourne. The big blackout was while we were in Melbourne. Yeah.
I think I might know the answer, but if you were going to have to choose between being given a boat or a camper van, what would you pick?
A boat, but just a kayak. A camper van would be a pain in the ass, man. Where am I going to park it?
It's a hypothetical. You don't need to worry about the logistics.
He's an engineer by trade.
Yeah, it's true. It's an engineer.
I think if you have too much stuff, it makes your life more complicated. So just a really simple boat that I can just paddle out.
I've got one last question before we finish. You've got very strong ethics and values. I think that really comes through. But what is the one thing which doesn't make any financial sense that is just a vice for you? It's just it's where you splurge.
Where do I splurge? Well, I mean, I've got more bikes than I need. I think I'm about to buy an e-mountain bike.
If you were going to consolidate the worth of all your bikes, what would it come to?
Well, not that much. Probably 20 grand at the moment.
I could buy a few Vespas for that. Finn Peacock, look, thank you for giving up your time and being so, opinionated as to in a fantastic way. I mean, it's what makes for a good podcast is to be really open and honest about your opinions and let us see the real you. And I think in an age where we're all pretending to be something that we're not, it's really refreshing to just come and sit and have a chat with you for now and pick your brains.
No worries. It's been fun.
Thanks for listening to Rooster Radio. Remember to check out roosterradio.biz to listen to more episodes and sign up to our mailing list. And if you like what we're doing, please leave us a review on iTunes. And finally, we're on Facebook at facebook.com/roosterradiohq.